This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alexander and Cleopatra are twin siblings known to graphic novel fans, and they're back on another big adventure. This time, they're on the high seas racing toward treasure, while their arch-enemy, the fearsome pirate Felix Worley, is in hot pursuit. The story is the brainchild of cartoonist and writer Hope Larson. Knife's Edge is a follow-up to her beloved graphic novel Compass South. The sequel contains underlying commentary about shifting gender roles and the importance of personal discovery, which has made it a hit with kids and teens, especially those who identify as queer. Hope recently made the move from Los Angeles back to Asheville, North Carolina, and beyond graphic novels, she is also the author behind the Batgirl series from DC Comics. Hope Larson joins us from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Hello, Hope.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you here. Tell us more about Knife's Edge now. And a lot of folks have been following Alex and Cleo, but for those of us who may not have been, tell us what they're up to in your latest graphic novel.
Sure. Well, Compass South, which was the book one, which came out last year, follows Alex and Cleo as they travel from New York to San Francisco and get separated along the way and then reunited. So Knife's Edge, book two, begins with them reunited and also reunited with their father and setting out on a voyage to find this lost treasure, which is their birthright.
And the separation is interesting because they've grown apart a little bit, as people do when they separate, even if they've been together for a long, long time. And that growth, that separate growth, plays a big part in Knife's Edge, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm writing mostly for middle school age kids, and you go through a lot of changes when you're that age. So the two of them have had these separate adventures over the course of the previous book, and by the time they get back together again, they're just not the same people that they were at the start of the story, and they both have to come to terms with those changes.
Tell us about the decision and the role of the decision to add, bring their father into the picture and what role that plays in this latest graphic novel.
Sure. Well, Alex and Cleo end up sort of fending for themselves and living on the street in book one because their father has disappeared. And when they find him again in book two, they learn that he's actually not their biological father. They're adopted. And also that their real parents, their birth parents, are pirates. So they have to reassess their ideas about themselves based on this new information. Their themes of, you know, if my parents are bad people, am I a bad person? What? Who am I really if I don't know where I come from? That kind of thing.
And they're on a search, and they think it's on a search for two family heirlooms that were passed down by their mother, Hester. But it gets much more complicated, much more interesting. But tell us about the heirlooms first.
The heirlooms are a pocket watch, which has a compass in it, and a knife. So there you get the names for the two books, Compass South and Knife's Edge. And the two items together have coded information embedded in them, and that leads them to the treasure.
Well, they've got that, and that's the stuff that's going to take them on this treasure hunt. Well, let's take a step back and talk about the inspiration for these characters. You say this is the second book in the series. Where did they come from?
I honestly have no idea where these characters came from. Mm-hmm. I've always had this fascination with doubles and twins. I'm not a twin myself. I think of them as being two aspects of the same person, really, male and female, sort of more passive and more active, masculine, feminine. I just really like stories that deal with duality. So I'm taking that and making it pretty literal in this story.
That duality is muted somewhat by the ambiguity, the gender ambiguity, particularly with Cleo. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah. So Cleo is cross-dressing. She's dressing as a boy because this story is set in the 1860s, and you couldn't really just go gallivanting around as a young girl in the 1860s. It's much easier if you're disguising yourself as a boy. So book one involves Cleo beginning to dress as a boy and experiencing all this freedom as a result of switching, presenting as a different gender. And book two, which reunites her with her brother and her father, they're not used to, she's changed a lot, and
right.
she's gotten used to having more freedom and taking more control over her life and just being a more active protagonist and less of a subservient character in her family life. So she's getting some pushback from them because they're not sure if they like these changes in her.
Yeah, and as you say, this happens because she's on the road, but not uncommon in that in the time period in which you've set this. If a woman was going to do anything on her own, she would pretty much have to either pass or somehow cross-dress to present herself as a more masculine figure, and that's historically a fact back in that period, right?
Yeah.
Tell us more about, they set sail with Captain Tarborough on the Elmira to track down the treasure, so let's talk more about this adventure on the high seas.
Sure. Tarborough is the first mate in the first book, and he sort of ascends to be captain of this ship in the second book. And he's a pretty fun character because he's a great swordsman who has been traveling incognito as a sailor. He's also kind of a surrogate father figure in book one. So Alex and Cleo both look up to him a lot. He teaches Cleo to sword fight and basically gives her permission to learn these skills that her father and brother are not super supportive of.
You say you aim this at middle schoolers. It is a graphic novel. Again, talk more about that universe and that market, if we can. Let's talk about the sort of the commercial side of that. Is that sort of where all writing should go these days? If we're looking for a middle school market, shouldn't we all be writing graphic novels?
I think everyone should be writing graphic novels. That sounds great. That's really all that I've ever done. I've never written a novel, and I've never been in that strictly prose space. I've been doing graphic novels for probably about 13, 14 years.
Go ahead, to finish that thought, yeah.
Yeah, it's just this beautiful hybrid of images and text, and there's nothing else like it. It's really my favorite art form.
Was it growing up? Is that what you read when you were younger?
I did read a fair amount of comics when I was a kid. I first got introduced to adventure-type comics, which is what this is, and sort of a big inspiration for me when I was 7, 8 years old, and my family moved over to France for a year. My dad is a professor, and he was on sabbatical. And my parents were willing to buy me a lot of these French comics, Asterix and Tintin, because it helped with my French comprehension. So I really got hooked on those and read a ton of them. And then when I came back to the U.S. a year later, there wasn't really an equivalent in the U.S. market. There's superhero comics.
I was just about to say that, and superhero comics are what come to mind if we think of comics or graphic novels at all. And therefore, there may be a feeling abroad that this is the province of men. What's your sense of who's writing these days and who's reading them?
Well, these days, in the book publishing market, it's definitely a female-dominated field, which I think is maybe surprising to a lot of people. But if people are listening to my show and they're familiar with kids' comics at all, they definitely know the name Raina Telgemeier. They may know Vera Brosgol, who did Ghosts. There are just a lot of real powerhouse female cartoonists out there, and they're the ones who are driving this market, and they're the ones who have brought kids' comics back into a central place in the U.S. This was not an industry that was viable until like 2005. That was when it really started coming back.
Why is that true? And why is it that women are driving this? And how did they do that? How did they bring it back?
I think probably what happened is that in the 90s, a lot of publishers started translating Japanese manga. That's Japanese comics. You've probably seen them. They're black and white, and you read them backwards. Those started being translated and brought over, and they got really popular. And U.S. publishers were like, let's get a slice of that manga money. So they started hiring domestic cartoonists to make new books.
And they happened to be women?
A lot of them, because a lot of the fans reading manga were girls. A lot of those books are specifically made for a female audience. So suddenly there were all these women who had grown up reading manga, grown up reading these comics that were made just for them and wanted to make them. And what I've heard from a lot of librarians and people who teach comics courses in college is that most of the kids in these classes are girls.
Wow. So that's
taken over.
And apparently have been for a while. And you, too, before writing this series, you had an adventure of your own. You adapted the fantasy novel A Wrinkle in Time, right?
That's right. I adapted it into a graphic novel.
Well, tell us.
And that one I wrote and drew.
Tell us more about that process. And again, I mean, this is a well-known novel that then it gets adapted. Did you initiate that, or were you under contract? How did that process take place?
I was contacted out of the blue by Margaret Ferguson, who's an editor at Ferrer, Straus & Giroux, who's continued to be my editor and my publisher since then. And she basically just emailed me and said, would you be interested in adapting A Wrinkle in Time into a graphic novel? And it's one of those emails that you get and you just read it like three times because you can't imagine how this could possibly be a real thing that's shown up in your inbox. And it must be a joke, you know? Yeah. And it wasn't. And I took that job and it completely changed my career and my life.
We'll talk about the process, though. I mean, you say you wrote it, but you're adapting. So and it's, you know, it's a big book. It's already there. You've got a plot to work with. So talk about that process of using your skill and your talents to then adapt a fairly well-known book like this.
Yeah, well, I should say off the front that it was really a nerve-wracking project because I'd grown up reading that novel. Mm. And so have a lot of other people. And a lot of people were concerned that I was not going to do it justice and was going to sully the good name of A Wrinkle in Time. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be as sensitive to the original work as I possibly could. So I wrote this script based on the book, which basically includes almost every line of dialogue. There's really nothing plot-wise. So yeah. I wrote this massive script, and then I drew this massive graphic novel based on the script. The original novel is, I think, around 200 pages long, and the graphic novel is twice that, so around 400.
Written by Madeline L'Engle.
That's right,
L'Engle.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is, again, moving into the province of women, and as you suggest, perhaps a surprise to some people when I say graphic novel or comic book, to know that there's this much going on. And I understand that not only was it nerve-wracking going in, but it actually took a toll on you physically, right?
It did. It's graphic making comics is a very physical act. Drawing all day is really hard on your body. So I injured myself a couple of times over the course of drawing that book. And plus, it was just tough mentally being in my house full time for like 2 years.
I have to interrupt you here because you're going to ask us to believe that you got hurt writing it, making a comic book. So do tell me more.
Sure. I got a repetitive stress injury from drawing, and that's basically what happened. And that happens to most cartoonists. I don't think I have any friends who are professional artists who don't have some kind of drawing injury. You go to a convention, you'll see a lot of cartoonists with these braces on their arms that they'll wear to sign and sketch at conventions.
There's a cartoon.
It's just really tough.
There's a cartoon in that only cartoonists would get, I guess. So then beyond that, now you're also working for DC Comics on the Batgirl series, right?
Yeah, I've been writing Batgirl for about a year, and that's a big change for me because I didn't grow up reading superhero comics, and it's like a completely different world from the one that I'm used to.
How are they different than Alex and Cleo?
They come out once a month typically. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing an issue of Batgirl every month and turning it around, which is it's quick. It's a lot of deadlines. Mm-hmm. And every issue has specific beats that you need to hit. Like you need a couple of good fight scenes in there. The big piece of advice that I got from my editors when I came onto the book is that on page one of Batgirl, just in case somebody doesn't realize that they have picked up Batgirl, you need to show Batgirl in her costume, and somebody needs to be shouting, Batgirl, every issue.
Every issue, first page.
Yeah.
Well, that it seems to me, I'm going to ask you about this because it might take us to a question about the an independent project like Knife's Edge and the creation of Alex and Cleo, who's sort of, that's your brainchild. You bring it to life, you bring it to the publisher. And then if you work for DC Comics, owned by Warner Brothers, we're looking at a big corporate media corporation here, which I'm thinking has done a lot of market research, a lot of focus groups, and has a lot of ideas about what your comic book should look like before they even send you a contract. And that might be a little different way to work. Am I right?
Yeah, it's very different. I kind of like it. I look at it as a challenge. It's I'm there to basically be a craftsperson and to create a product that is going to be fun and exciting and familiar to people who love superhero comics, and to do it in a way that is as sophisticated and as literary as I can from my end.
That's pretty cool. And I understand that the Batgirl series has sent you to YouTube looking for martial arts scenes. Am I right?
It has. If I'm writing a fight scene and I want to reference a specific move, I'll usually look it up on YouTube and then send that video to the artist that I'm working with.
Now,
I've learned a lot about martial arts.
Martial arts. Well, see, there you go. It's a learning. It's all a learning process. You are back in Asheville now. You lived out in L.A. for a number of years. Tell us about that transition. You know, what it was like for you in L.A. and why you decided to move back.
Sure. I was in L.A. for about 7 years, and it's an amazing city. It's a very expensive city. So I'd kind of gotten to this point where I wanted a higher quality of life, and I didn't want to work myself to death out there to just scrape by. So I decided to move back to Asheville and be closer to my parents and my family and just be able to enjoy a better quality of life. And the thing that's cool about being back here is that it's actually really great for my career too, because now I can make choices based on the projects that I really want to be taking rather than just the projects that pay me the most money.
Would you say you'd have to, does it make a difference to be in a place like LA, a media center, if you want to get started? Because it strikes me, obviously you can do this from anywhere, but you can't get known anywhere. And I wonder if that makes a difference. If you had to be in LA for that period, now you've established yourself, you can move back.
It's important to live in a city, I think, in LA or New York, and to make those connections, those career connections. But I did that. I have the connections now, and it's not really going to hurt anything for me to be outside of a city, a big city.
So what's next for Alex and Cleo?
Well, we're seeing if we can do another book. I'm not sure yet. And I'm, meanwhile, continuing to write Batgirl. I have another graphic novel coming out next year, which is a middle grade slice of life book called All Summer Long. So
you're busy.
What about any of this stuff?
How much of it do you then look to get it translated into animation? Is that sort of a next step for you? Are you perfectly happy making graphic novels? Would you like to see them come to life? How's that work?
I am happy making graphic novels. I am actually involved with some animation projects right now, but I can't tell you what they are. So you never know. Stay tuned.
We will stay tuned. Hope Larson is a cartoonist and a writer of comic books and graphic novels. And she joined us from Asheville. You can find out more details about her new graphic novel. It is called Knife's Edge, and you'll find that at our website, stateofthings.org. And on our next Movies on the Radio, by the way, we're going to talk about vacations. But before I do that, I want to thank you very much for being on the program, Hope. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The next Movies on the Radio, we're going to talk about vacation movies, your favorite or least favorite vacation film. You can send us an email at sot@wunc.org to tell us your favorite. We'll get in touch with you and put you on our next program. Even more imminent is comedian Ted Alexandro. He's coming up on our program. He's a New York comic coming to North Carolina, and you'll hear him on The State of Things in just a moment. Stay tuned.